Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Go live on Facebook. Yes, this is Jamala Rogers, your host for Voices from the Battlefield. And I am smiling because we had a series of technical difficulties. I'm not on my regular laptop, and it's like some things that weren't there that needed to be there. But we are here. We are rejuvenated from all of the activities over the weekend. The spirit of Juneteenth is alive and well. So we are grateful to be here. These are some interesting times we are in. Some people may look at the glass half full, and some of it like no glass and nothing else in it. But there's some things that are happening, because I keep reminding you that there has been a disintegration of our democracy with two branches not working for us, and that is the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. So there's three branches. And what I've said is we are that fourth branch, the people. And it's taken a minute for us to realize that this stuff is dysfunctional, is not working for us, and that we are going to have to be the ones who push the democracy forward, this experiment called a democracy. And what we've seen in the last few months is a increased activity of people in a very targeted way. So protests are fine, and I've told you I'm not against protests altogether, but they must have some demands and they must have some targets. And so around the country, people are manifesting. And so you have now the government, not our government, but the current regime has pulled back on the sale of these concentration camps. And I also remind you that those are not just for, quote, undocumented workers. They're for all of us and any of us. So people have put up enough stink about those that the seven detention centers that they purchased at about $700 million price tag, they pulled back on that. And now they're trying to do something else with them, sell them, whatever. But it's based on the work of the people and the protest, the righteous anger that folks have said, not now, not in our neighborhood, not here. And we are not going to be retaining people, particularly when we know what you all are doing in those facilities, right? So people are being, women are being raped. Folks are not getting food and water. They're not getting medical supplies. And so it's actually an intensification of what we know for Americans' prisons. So all of that happens too, but now it's on steroids. And this is all brought to you by, you know, a person in the White House who is a 34-count felon, a pathological liar, and a GOP. And, you know, we redefine that as guardian of pedophiles. So when we see the wickedness of this regime, and the people who are willing to go along with it for fear or for the fact that they are still stealing our money right up under our noses, and we can't seem to get anybody to do anything about it until now, where now the courts are starting to step in and say, no, you can't have that $1.8 billion to give to the January 6th insurrectionists. That's not going to happen. So I just want you to know the courts are not oblivious to public sentiment. They hear and see what we're feeling, what we're saying. One of the things that we know is going on now is the war. And what I've been telling you about this war with Iran is we lost any advantage. We mean the American people, because that's our money. And it's been estimated that it's costing us a couple of billion dollars a day. this thing, this excursion, as you know, PP has would say, is this is going to be over in a few days. We're going to do some shock and awe, and we're going to get control. We're going to do a regime change, and we're going to get all of those nuclear weapons. Well, look at us now, y'all. We've already, the regime, the Trump regime, has already conceded defeat. They just haven't said it like that. They are allowing the Iranians to buy oil for cash, even though none of the agreements have been met. And we also know that Israel has played a big role in this, because they, you know, Netanyahu's he got Trump to agree to this so-called excursion of Iran because he wanted cover for what he's doing in Lebanon with Hezbollah. So if you don't connect the dots, you don't quite understand what's going on, but we understand clearly what's going on. There is expansion by Zionism and capitalist corporations who want the oil, who want the land, who want the resources. And all of this is being done in the name of our people here in this country and our tax dollars. And I have to say that anytime somebody's in your pocket taking your money that you could be doing something else with, you ought to be outraged. We've just seen the making of a trillionaire. None of us had even made it to a millionaire, y'all. This man is a trillionaire based on the subsidies and contracts the MAGA regime has gotten him. And I'm talking about none other than Elon Musk, the person who you remember had the chainsaw cutting up, you know, government waste. And a lot of our people suffer from that, you know, as a result of him doing his Doge thing. Something like 300,000 Black women lost their jobs in federal government. So it's clear that this is a government that is anti anything except white billionaire male Christians. And the rest of us are not fitting into the mold. And so we are going to be locked out, and particularly for Black folks, the anti-Black sentiment and actions is very apparent. In terms of, you know, the defunding of historically Black colleges, of other Black institutions, of even things like SNAP. They recently, bipartisan housing plan was passed, and this fool refuses to sign it. So that would have given some relief. But yeah, so we are in this fight basically on our own. So we got to get organized. We got to get strategic. And we got to be committed for the long haul. So having said that, we know what our assignment is. And there are people who are accepting those assignments all across the country, wherever they may be needed. And it's going to look different in different places. We are still battling against a police state here in St. Louis. They recently brought a drone. There is the installment of these data centers. So people have been like steadily pushing back on that stuff. And so we need to continue to do that. Hopefully in the future, I'm gonna have somebody talking about those data centers. So yeah, cause we don't understand what that means. We believe that little hype about it. It's gonna be some jobs. No, y'all, no, it's not. Let's not go for the hype again, okay? So we have on the show today a very special person in our community that some of you all probably don't know, because he is a person of modest demeanor, and so he's rarely out there beating the drum for himself. And so he does stuff in a quiet but effective way. And I'm talking about none other than Terry Kennedy, who we call Kujaliwa Hukuma. So karibu to the show.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
So some of you all might remember Kennedy from the boardroom, because it was many years as an alder person, and then he transitioned to being clerk of the Board of Alders. And when you saw him on TV, he appeared to be very serious, very much about the business of our people. And some of you said, does that brother ever smile?
No.
This brother has a very witty sense of humor. He is a drummer. He is a boot dancer. He's a historian, a poet, and a future book author. So this is a man of many, many, many talents. And so Kujaliwa, you heard me say future book author.
I heard that. I did pick it up. Is that your way to urge me to go ahead and do a book? to encourage me.
All your time in city government. That'll happen. How many progressive politicians do we know that spent that kind of time in city government that does not have some stories to tell, some lessons to be learned?
Right. It's true. And I've had a number of people mention that to me. So it's something I'm beginning to take even more seriously.
Okay. And I'm not going to say I'd help you write it. I would help with the editing and reviewing.
Well, I am happy and pleased by the offer.
Okay.
And I should be able to do something. I have a journalism degree from Howard University.
I know you know how to write.
Yeah, I should be able to do that.
So what's the problem now?
Well, initially it was simply having the time, because I was so busy doing, I didn't have the time to take to write. But I believe at this point in my life, I have that opportunity.
And so I'm thinking that because you've been out for, a couple of years now?
I stopped being an alderman in 2019. So from 1989 to 2019, that was 30 years. And a number of things I was doing as chairman of the caucus. You know, I sponsored much of the serious and major legislation, like for civilian oversight, for even things for local control. I sponsored the first resolution, promoting Juneteenth for the city to celebrate, but also in support of John Conyers' resolution that he had to do a study about the lingering effects of slavery. We got a resolution passed at the Board of Aldermen in support of that study. And then a number of other things. I sponsored the Minority and Women Business Enterprise Bill. I sponsored the bill to fund that study. And then a number of other things in terms of housing and equality and to end various types of discrimination. I sponsored the legislation that pushed the city or forced the city to not buy products at that time from apartheid South Africa. And so that was significant. To get passed by a major city to pass that kind of thing. It was also a lot of work. So many of the major pieces of legislation that we consider to be both pushing equality and also for social justice for people of color and all others were legislations and types of legislation that I sponsored. I was also chair of the African American Automatic Caucus.
And so kept me busy. Do you see what we just did? We just did the outline for your book.
Oh, we did? Okay.
Yeah. So now it's going to be easy to take all this stuff that you said, follow it, talk about the different stories behind it, and there's your book.
Yeah.
See how easy that was?
I'll know it once I start trying to put pen to paper or start typing it up, how easy that is.
Yeah.
Because, I also did the legislation for, environmental corrections that need to be made in the city as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know many of our organizations, you were the go-to legislator. And I in some ways, I hated that you always had to be the one, but we couldn't necessarily count on other people and to count on the serious follow-through. So, just publicly want to thank you for your service and service to, our social movements and all the stuff that you named helped to move that. And so now we see a lot of that is being taken back. And that ought to anger us because you just talked about how much work it is to put those things into to law and to put them into action. And so when we see them being rolled back and attacked, that ought to be some impetus for us to say, no. We know how much work went into that. That still is a viable human and civic right, constitutional right that we have to maintain. So thank you, Asante, for all of that. And looking forward to your book.
Okay, that's about the fifth time you said it. I guess I should take it very seriously.
Yeah.
I would also raise that, I sponsored the legislation that did the non-binding referendum, asking people of the city of St. Louis if they wanted their police department back under their control.
Yeah.
And that came back some 90-some-odd% that people said yes. It was non-binding. It couldn't force it. But we wanted to get a sense of the people of the city of St. Louis of what they wanted.
Yeah, and that really helped us to move in under Coalition Against Police Crimes, the whole campaign. That was informing us that we are not doing this by ourselves. People really want this. And when we finally got the vote, we saw where the whole state said, oh, yes, St. Louis needs to have control of its own department. So the fact that the Republican state legislator arbitrarily said, no, we're going to do this. We don't care what the people said.
Yeah.
In St. Louis or the state, we know what we want. And this is coming from, you know, white men in the state legislature. So there we have it. Our battles are always before us. And so, yeah, here we go. So
I think where people, if I can, I think where people make the mistake of thinking that St. Louis is in the Midwest. And I just point out to people, if it is, it's one of the few Midwestern states that had slavery.
Yeah.
St. Louis and its legislatures at the state level, I can't say all of them, but the majority of them were Confederate sympathizers and actually supported slavery in the state of Missouri.
Yeah.
And that has significant impact upon what we're facing today. Many of those laws were never changed that were enacted during slavery times in the state of Missouri. So we have to be clear and understand the history, because that helps you to understand what you're up against and what you must do.
Yeah.
A poor analysis will create a poor response.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes people don't want to take the time to understand the historical perspective or the series of events that took place before they began their work to understand what they must do today. Missouri was a slave state. St. Louis sold people of color off the steps of the old courthouse, and then off the steps of the actual slave pen, which they kept down the street where now the baseball stadium is located.
Right.
And on my mother's side of the family, they were held in bondage in Missouri. We were not, that part of the family was not down in Alabama, Mississippi. They've been held in bondage in the state of Missouri from the time that they were brought here in 1720. We have traced it back that far.
Yeah.
There were a group of Africans that were brought up here directly from Haiti, up the Mississippi to the DeSoto area by a guy by the name of Pierre Reynaud. And he brought 500 Africans, of which our family was one of them, and were held in bondage there in DeSoto. So slavery, as we understand it, is not that far away. My grandfather, my mother's father, was born 1883. My father's mother was born 1878. My point is, they were a part of the first generation completely born free. That meant my great-grandparents on both sides were people who had been held in bondage. That meant my grandparents were the first generation. My mother and father were the second generation. And we, their descendants, are just the third. It is not as far away as you may think. And then to think that we have recovered from all of that would be the wrong analysis. Now, my oldest sister, Dr. Joyce Kennedy, is a you know, has her doctorate degree in psychology and was over the psychology department at Governor State University. She talks about this thing called epigenetics. Now, I'm not a psychologist and I don't know all the details, but she gave us a clear analysis that various types of traumas can embed themselves around your DNA, and that is transferred from one generation to the next. So then to think that after three or four generations, that has dissipated what has been encoded around that DNA would be the wrong analysis. So that means that some of us don't have either the zeal or the full impetus to, one, fight back, and two, to live with a Black consciousness. There is this thing about us having self-hate. And I'm saying all of us, but some of us, and enough to color the work that we have to do today. Our point simply being is understanding the history helps us in a clear analysis of what we must do today.
Yeah.
To leave it out is to leave off one of your feet by which you want to walk to do the work that you do.
Well said, well put. And I'm hearing, I don't remember the exact term, but that the fact that trauma is captured in the DNA and held in the body over generations.
Yes.
I mean, that's been documented. And I think we're just coming to, some of us, the realization as to why Black people act the way they do. And so sometimes when we don't understand that ourselves, then we get gaslit, like y'all. And really, like, we don't even understand what's propelling us forward as human beings. And because of that, like you said, we operate at a deficit, and we operate always being reactive.
Mm-hmm.
And also doing self-harm. So
So
I think the more that we understand the history of our existence, both here and on the route here, the better off we'll be. And I also, like you, Kujuliwa, I count Missouri as a southern state. And if I'm in a position where, you have those regional group offs, if I have the power, I'm like, we need to be in the southern, because if you understand how to organize, the organizing in the south is much different than in the
It is
north.
much different.
And so it's
It
for
is.
us in Missouri, it's closer to the south. And the fact that you pointed out all the different elements of being a slave state really helped to document that. So I want us to talk about, like, we are approaching this whole 250th anniversary of the US. And a couple of weeks ago, Renato Carr was on the show talking about the lynching of James Person in 1942 and the unique elements around that. And it was very interesting. But I always point out that lynching in its many forms are still with us today. And in fact, in May, there had been a lynching, like a real lynching, like a tree lynching.
Right, tree
But
lynching, yes.
it comes in many forms, as you know, Kujuliwa, because I point out, and I count, as many people do, anytime white people take it upon themselves to seek justice without due process, that's a lynching. And because of who we are, because people look at us as subhuman, as second-class citizens, white people feel like they can do that without any repercussions. So it's been done, whether it be Zimmerman in Florida taking it upon himself to kill that young person, whether this person over there decides that, this kid is playing his music too loud so I can kill him. I mean, we have so many examples. It's not always agents of the state, like the police or the National Guard. It's like everyday white people who feel like that's what they can do. And history said that most of the time they can get away with it. It's justified. So we got that reality in terms of a lynching mentality. And also, most of us include capital punishment in that, because that's definitely a way that they still kill black folks. So where are we in this day and age? And we're also coming up on the anniversary of the East St. Louis, Maafa. And I want you to talk a little bit about the history of that and why we call it a Maafa. And because I know certain people might not know that right across the river, we had one of the worst massacre this country has seen. So, and then I want you to also talk about your family's relationship to that whole incident.
Certainly. It's a story. And it's history. First of all, the present national leadership has caused some individuals who might not have said anything 20 years ago to take actions and do racist stuff that they might not have done before as openly. That doesn't mean that every white person is doing that, but there is a feeling and sense, a vibe out there that these things are permissible now because of the national leadership that you see, which has also empowered some of the state leadership to say very denigrating and racist things. And again, that's not every white person, but some have managed to get themselves in political power and use that as a platform to consistently both attack and to perpetrate these attitudes of both discrimination, racism, and oppression. It behooves us all, including fair-minded white people, to say something and to raise the issue and to counteract it as much as they can. However, when it comes to our movement as a people, they can't speak for us. We have to do it ourselves. It's called self-determination. And if they want to support us, they need to listen to what we need for them to do and not take the paternalist position of trying to say what is best for us. Even those some who may have what they call a progressive attitude, they have to be careful to listen to those of us who are involved and help and assist in what we say. In 1917, there was a major, what our elders called, race war in East St. Louis. This happened July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of 1917. As you know, this was early on in World War I. There was a fear. In East St. Louis had a number of steel and metalwork companies. You had the aluminum ore company. and on and on. And so people were able to get jobs at these locations, including some Black folks. So the white workers there primarily wanted to get higher pay, which was their right. They're working in these factories, and working in a steel mill is not easy. And so they went on strike. There was a fear then that was propagated that Black workers were going to cross these lines and try to break the strike, that the companies would hire Black folks to replace them. Well, that created an uneasiness in East St. Louis. Now, at that time, East St. Louis was not an emptied out city, and it was not a predominantly Black city either. It had a significant Black population, but it was predominantly a white city. So the city was pretty well developed, with a developed downtown. They went out all the vacant lots in 1917. It was a growing area. So these workers were concerned that Black folks were going to take their jobs. Now, my family, my father is from East St. Louis, and his mother and father from East St. Louis. Those were the Kennedys and the Horns in East St. Louis. Some people who may be old enough to know Cleopatra Horn, who taught music at Lincoln High School, was my aunt, and she taught Miles Davis music in East St. Louis. So some people who were old enough to know that might have had her as a teacher. And some of my constituents, when I was an alderman of the 18th, were descendants from East St. Louis and knew the Horns that were there and some of the Kennedys in East St. Louis. Nonetheless, early on, though the actual rioting, they call it, happened July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of 1917, as early as February and March of that year, people were taking pot shots at Black youth trying to go to school. Our father and uncles talked about how they would have to, because they were been 10, 9, 8, 10, in those ages, how their uncles would have to walk to school with them with rifles to ensure that nobody shot them on their way to school. This is early as February, March, April. Well, things began to intensify till finally there were Black vehicles or Black sedans driving through the Black community, we call the bottoms, shooting into people's homes. And they were, you know, filled with white men. Finally, the community said, no, we're not going to have this anymore. And so some of the families organized themselves and waited for this sedan to come back through. And so as they saw a Black sedan come through, they were fearful that it was going to be a shooting again, because it had come through several times, about five or six times through the community. And so they shot at it. The sheriff was in that particular car and got hit. Well, that caused an ongoing series of attacks upon the Black community, because the word went out they killed the sheriff, which I have to admit, some years ago, we heard from a descendant of that sheriff apologizing for their family's participation in what happened afterwards. What happened? Hordes of mobs of white people began to attack the Black community. You go online, you can find some pictures of how they stopped a streetcar in East St. Louis, broke out the window, dragged a woman out and beat her to death. So with some white women doing it with their high heel shoes on the street. This happened in, 1917? This is before Tulsa. They burned the Black section down. They were trying to kill as many, if not every Black person they could possibly find in East St. Louis at that time. It was horrendous. In 1997, we held a commemoration, the 80th commemoration. And one of the elders there was a child. He was coming to East St. Louis with his family. They were coming there looking for a job. They were walking across the bridge. That would have been the Black bridge at the time. They said that they had no place else to go. But as they were coming across the bridge, it looked like all of East St. Louis was on fire. She said they saw nothing but smoke and houses and buildings that were on fire. They said it looked like an apocalypse. And a white guy told them, you all don't want to go over there. But they had no place else to go. So they continued on into the city. It was a major, major attack upon this community trying to kill every Black person they can find. Our grandfather, our father's father, whose name was Norval Kennedy, was doing some union organizing over there in East St. Louis. He disappeared early in the attacks, which we know he was killed because he never showed back up. The house, the Kennedy home, was attacked there in East St. Louis. They were shooting in the front of the house and throwing torches into the back. My grandmother, my father's mother, her name was Catherine Horn Kennedy, jumped out the side window with an uncle and all of her children, which included our father, and hid in the tall grass that was to the west of the house. And they stayed there for about 12 or 14 hours until the crowd dissipated. They could hear them say, "We got them," and they left. Then she tried to get across the bridge and heard out that they were not allowing Black folks into St. Louis over the East Bridge. So she put together, and my uncle, a bunch of wood that they can find from some of the other houses that were burned, and built a raft and brought her children over to St. Louis across that raft. That is, if she had not done that, I wouldn't be sitting here today. There probably would not be Horns and Kennedys from East St. Louis in existence today. Why is that important? Well, Cleopatra Horn, as I said, taught Miles Davis music. He in turn brought my cousin into the music, Shirley Horn, who was a major jazz singer. She in turn, Shirley, mentored Roberta Flack and some work with Donny Hathaway. If Catherine Horn had not done that, we would not be sitting here, and that would not have been the case today. So one thing touches another, which is called something else. Ultimately, they ended up on this side. She died a few months later, which put Samuel Kennedy, my father, and Hollister Kennedy, my uncle, all out on the street because they had completely lost everything, the Horns and the Kennedys. The Urban League, ultimately, as you know, Ida B. Wells came here. She was sent here. She did an article from that with the NAACP and others. They got together and they formed the St. Louis branch of the Urban League. That branch was created to give relief to the survivors of the East St. Louis race war, as the elders called it. They in turn bought land in Kinloch and began to relocate some of the survivors out in Kinloch. That's how Kinloch became a Black city. So we had family that lived in Kinloch, and our father and uncles would walk from what was left in East St. Louis of the homes out to Kinloch following the train tracks. That's a long way by foot, but they had nothing else. And that's how they survived. Ultimately, many of the elders, so I not just didn't know, we just didn't get the story from our father. In 1997, my twin brother Thaddeus was doing some research for the upcoming activity that he was pushing to have. He met an elder, and I can't think of her name, and it come to me. She was 100 years old. Some people have told him there's a centurion over here at this home. So he went there and he spoke to her to ask her questions, and she was in and out of sleep. And finally, she woke up. She said, "Baby, who is you?" And he said, you know how the elders are. "Baby, who is you?" He said, "My name is Thaddeus Kennedy." She said, "Kennedy, Kennedy, I heard that mama built a raft and took them children across that river." And so my brother actually began to cry to come across someone who knew the story he had never met before, because East St. Louis was a tight-knit community. Now, we just did not allow it to happen. You know, because it was by surprise. It was a surprise attack. The church there began to ring the bells to let Black folks know something was happening. As things began to go further, the Masonic orders began to bring what they called hearses over to pick up the dead. Inside those caskets were guns so we could protect ourselves. A number of other folks allowed Black people to come in. This even stretched itself out of East St. Louis into Brooklyn, Illinois, which is, now I believe, is the oldest all-Black city in the country. And so it became a widespread event that our elders called the East St. Louis Race War. They just didn't call it the riot, because to them, they were at war since February of that year to protect and defend themselves while trying to not just survive, but to thrive and advance, because they came to East St. Louis for new opportunities. The effects of it, East St. Louis never recovered from it. Most of that area there where the rioting took place is now vacant land. There is the community college that initially started out. It is there at that location. It is in the area where much of that happened at. A number of those families moved to St. Louis, some out into Kinloch. And then you had white flight from East St. Louis to where you see it is today. One thing affects another, but understanding that history will help you to understand what you see when you look at East St. Louis, mm-hmm. and how it got to that place. Mm-hmm. And then having that analysis can also help you to come up with a solution on how to improve it. So that tells a little bit of that story. There's lots more of how they survived afterwards.
And what I was about to say, Kuja Levi, is that I do believe it was when Ida B. Wells came and raised Rutgers and raised it to a national level that caused the investigation. And so there are hearings that people can go to and documents that talk about what happened there. Can you speak a little bit to, I know that was one fearless sister. I mean, because she literally came by herself to do it and with no fear of what could happen in her own personal safety. So, I mean, I got plenty of respect for that sister. But talk about like the investigation into the Mu'afa that now exists for us to go to and actually study ourselves.
Yeah, there were some, you know, court hearings. They primarily sentenced a black doctor. But the point is that information, there were some things that were raised in the court hearings that were documented and become archives for our generations to look at and to see what was being said about what happened, who was involved, and how this thing kicked off. They, you know, we cannot depend upon the white media to give us both always factual information. So they'll say that 300 black folks were killed, or some will say 150. And the black community was more like 1,200 to 1,500 that they knew were missing and could not be found. We can name at least five or six of our own family alone that disappeared from it. And like I said, even our grandfather very early on in that process. So yes, there were hearings. Yes, there were court cases that were raised and brought up. But we can't say justice came from it.
Right.
We cannot say reparations came from it, but it does provide some documentation about what happened and some guidance also about who was involved. Though they ultimately sentenced this black doctor to a heavier sentence than anybody else. Basically, those who were white just got a slap on the hand out of it. And there's several books out there, none at this point that are written by descendants. And so many of the descendants now are talking about coming together and writing something. There's an Ann Walker that we worked with in the 100th commemoration when we did that on the East Bridge. Mm-hmm. And when we did the one in 1997, which was the 80th anniversary, we expected maybe 100 people. We did get a call from somebody who identified themselves as a part of the Belleville Ku Klux Klan. They told us we better tell this history right. And we were fine. We were waiting on them to show up. We invited them to come. They never did make it. But where we expected maybe 100 people, we had more like four that showed up at that event. The room was packed. When we did the 100th commemoration, which was a much larger activity that we were also working with several groups and organizations in East St. Louis. When we did the march onto the bridge, we had about 5,000 people or more to show up. In August of that year of 1917, a little bit later.
Can I stop you because that 100th where we walked over the bridge and you all did the ceremony with the flowers.
Yes, ma'am.
That was some powerful stuff right there. And I know everybody had to feel it right to the bones, like what that meant. And it was really a beautiful thing. I've never seen anything like that and haven't seen it since. So I just wanted to interject that.
Well, thank you, because, you know, it's a lot to tell. So help me out here. You know, you're correct. The march was mimicking the march that happened in 1917 in Harlem. Thousands of black folks got together and walked the streets in silence, in protest, and to bring attention to what happened to East St. Louis. So what we did then was to reenact that from the area in which things happened. We did a march. And as I said, thousands of people showed up. We expected quite a few, but not that many. 5,000 is a low number. But the bridge was filled with folks coming over. At the front, we had a huge wreath. And then we had flowers. The idea was to give remembrance to those who lost their lives and even respect to those who survived and the resilience that it took to build families and reorganize families afterward. And so all of those flowers went into the Mississippi River from the bridge. We had the mayor of St. Louis at the time, that was Lyda Crewson, and then the mayor of East St. Louis, who was also a woman, a black woman. And so you had these two mayors that spoke. We had representatives from Congressman Clay's office, Lacey Clay. We had various state representatives. We had members of the entire African-American Automatic Caucus there. We had former mayors of East St. Louis there. We had the Masonic Order there, came out in their full regalia because they were a part of helping both the relief and the protection of our communities at that time. We have representation from NAACP. OBS was there. We encouraged them all to bring their banners so people could see the importance of this. We had representation from the Urban League and lots of other groups and organizations and churches and congregations that showed up to give this honor and remembrance. Now, our family every year goes down to the river since our grandmother brought us over, and we put flowers in the river for in remembrance of her and the family members. It's getting harder and harder to get to the river because of all the things that they're doing down there now.
Yeah.
That's really restricting access to it, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened when we did the commemoration 2017, the 100th commemoration. And that gives you some background of it. But yes, there was a court case. Yes, it did document information. That information is important because, you know, a lot of things come out. The judge or the juries will make whatever decision that they make. But the attorneys made sure that more information got out through that court case than what was being covered in the majority press.
Yeah, the testimonies of actual victims and their families. Yeah. So I'm thinking, though, as we come up on the 250, I've been asking guests, how should people of African descent be looking at the 250th anniversary of this country? And I recall that, first of all, it was through settler colonization that folks were even here.
Right.
So it was a genocide of the indigenous people. And then here comes what people would call the original sin of this country, and that is, you know, the enslavement of African people.
Mm-hmm.
But we are a part of what is now called the United States.
Correct.
And we have different relationships to the history, to the power, to the life. And so I know that generally on July 4th, there's not a lot of flag waving. Families come together, but that's really a social event for families. They are not saying this whole patriotic thing, like, you know, we are so proud to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you see us at this stage, particularly given what has happened to us under the current Trump regime? How should we be celebrating or not? And how should we be reflecting on our time here, which exceeds the 250th anniversary?
Mm-hmm.
We've been here a long time.
I mean, I think we need to be realistic about it. That's the first thing. To be clear about our relationship to the United States, to be clear about the annals of slavery that we went through, to be clear about the disenfranchisement that we've had. And that's not to be cynical. That is simply to be realistic about it. I think that it can be a great time for us to renew our effort towards justice, to renew our effort for both inclusion and our self-determination as a people. It can be a great time for us to do that. And if we want to do that around the barbecue pit, that's okay. But to be clear about, because we would not disincentivize somebody from trying to take that time to be with family and to enjoy family, because we got that time off from work and we need to use it. But it can be some things that we keep in our mind and maybe say around the food, reminding ourselves of our true relationship, that we have been an exploited people and that we have fought against it and that our survival has been based upon our work. Where would America be if it hadn't been for the civil rights movement? Where would America be if it hadn't been for the Black Power movement? Where would America be without George Washington Carver? He helped initiate the whole notion of having an ecology movement. Where would it be without Black women who stood up, or let's say Soldier on the Truth, when she did that great speech about I am a woman and showed her breasts? Where would the women's movement be if it hadn't been for Black women? So we have been at the core of most, some would say, of all of the social justice movements and activities that have been in America. We can be proud of that fact. And when the celebration comes around for 250 years, we can celebrate our work that has made America a more humane place than what it would have been if we were not here. Now, that doesn't mean that it's been humane. I said a more humane place than what it could have possibly have been if we had not been here. So we can celebrate our participation and our work towards making America a better place to be. We can celebrate that during that time period, but we must be realistic and recognize we should also use it as a time to recommit ourselves to the efforts of bringing both social justice and equity to those who've been oppressed by America. And we have been one of the largest groups that have been oppressed by America. Now you know they always try to say, in the city of St. Louis, you can't pop your fireworks. But I'll say this, and I'm not encouraging that, but I'll say this much, that there is a way that you can do it, that you can do it legally, and you might want to check the laws. However, if I can just bring this back to the Juneteenth a little bit, St. Louis, first of all, well, I have to tell this story. St. Louis, if I got time, I'll do it real quick. St. Louis developed one of the largest liberation fronts, or what some would call Black abolitionist organizations in America. They were called the Knights of Liberty and the Daughters of Table. In 1842, they organized themselves at the International Order of 12, by what's presently Delmar and 7th Street. They met secretly. Their leader was a man by the name of Moses Dixon, and his wife, they called her Mother Dixon. They had made it their sacred obligation to free Black folks from slavery, period. They had determined to do it by arms. So they trained for 10 years and recruited Black folks into the service of the Knights of Liberty and Daughters of Table. According to their records, they had organized some 60,000 Black folks secretly. And in 10 years later, they were going to invade Atlanta first and take the entire South for Black folks. Bold, audacious, both goals and moves. Their leader had a vision that America was going to go into a civil war and decided not to do anything in 1852. They waited. The Civil War broke out. The North was not winning initially. The South was more committed to their ends than many of the Northerners were. When Lincoln finally figured that out and determined that the only way they're going to win is to have Black troops and allow Black troops in, they got some 60,000 already trained Black women and men ready to fight for our freedom. If that had not been the case, the Civil War would not have been won by the North. We did that with the sweat and tears and blood of our own hands. And we must tell that story. So our point is that America can celebrate its 250th anniversary based upon our sweat and tears and what we brought more justice to this place. So then that's what it can mean for us. If it had not been for that, that kind of freedom would not have hit. And the major social changes that we've seen for improvement came much from our stamina and consistency in raising issues. Now, we can also be realistic that every time that there is perceived an advancement by people of color, America responds. When they could perceive that we got free, then you had the whole Ku Klux Klan, the lynchings beginning to happen, and then later, segregation, legalized segregation and exploitation. It was perceived that many whites in America, that the election of Obama was an advancement for the Black community. And as one elder said, Obama was elected to be president of the United States, not president of Black America. He was president of the United States. That was our Mama Francis. Our point is that it was perceived that it was an advancement for Black folks. There was a response. The response is what we're seeing today. Trump and Trumpism and the whole MAGA movement. History can help us understand that. Typically, when there is a perceived advancement of Black folks, there is a kickback, a response. It has happened consistently each and every time. However, so far, no matter how bad the response, it has never pushed us back further. It has never pushed back and ended all of the advancements that we have done. So we still incrementally make that movement forward, even though some things are adjusted in the opposite direction. We must be persistent and we must be consistent, and then teach the next generations to be realistic about what their work is going to have to be as well. I tell you this, in some African traditions, before an elder passes, it becomes a responsibility of the children to sit with them and to talk about what it is they wanted to do in advance of what they would like the family to continue. And that way, the work can be transported from one generation to the next. Now, the child's job is not to necessarily agree to everything, but they can agree to those things with the parent. It's called reconciling with the parent and reconciling with that parent on what you will continue and what you feel you cannot in that generation. But in that way, the knowledge goes from one generation to the next. I mentioned that, so we might want to start trying to do that, not wait until the person passes.
Absolutely, absolutely.
To begin to talk about what we can do. So I will be quiet now.
No, I just, you know what? I thought about, that is definitely a ritual that needs to happen, because when we look at probably the last 2-3 generations, I can say that we are not educating our children about the struggle. We acted like it got here because of the good wishes of some white people. And that's not the case, as you so eloquently pointed out. Everything we have, we had to fight for it. Mm-hmm. Every piece of dignity that we had, we had to fight for it. And I would say also, when you were mentioning like all the things, the accomplishments of why America is great, why the United States is great, we need to step back and say that one of the reasons it became a financial powerhouse is because of the free labor of some 200 years, and even under Jim Crow, some more of that in different forms that created the wealth of this country. And so we have every right to expect some of the benefits of that. And we don't even understand that. We think that because we've been told that, you know, you don't get a handout. We ain't talking about no damn handout. We talking about what is owed to us. And we're not, that's not even reparations that we're talking about. That's a whole nother cut. We're talking about what you got from us when you extracted free labor, when you stole land, when you stole inventions, when you stole other intellectual property. Mm-hmm. We are owed. Mm-hmm. You don't deal with the reparations piece. So Black people need to come into this particular period with some pride, with some dignity, with some understanding of the past, so that we can build on it. Because if you don't know that, I mean, that's the reason why Sankofa is real. We got to go back and bring it with us, so that we understand both the beauty, brilliance, and tenacity of people of African descent. Because that's the only reason we're here. We're not here because of the goodness of somebody. We're here because we fought. We felt like we deserved to be here. We deserved to be citizens. We deserve all the things that come with that. Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes that gets lost in the in all the battle about, like, you know, what America is and what Black people are. In the last few minutes, Kujaliwa, can you talk about the upcoming events? Because I want people to know about that, and we and how they can get involved.
If I can, I'll speak about that. But one thing I just want to mention: keep in mind that there's a whole series of historical events that happened that came up to and brought chattel slavery. That's because people don't make all these connections. You know, at one point, the Moors controlled Southern Europe. Well, the major battle that they lost was in 1492. And when that happened, who also was able to do something in 1492? Columbus. So there's a direct relationship between this ancient history and chattel slavery in America that's not often told, but our Black historians tell it. John Henry Clark, Dr. Chancellor Williams, and many others tell that story. We need to listen. The event, there's going to be a commemorative event on July 2nd at 6 p.m. In East St. Louis. We'll be putting another wreath out. There's a plaque, a memorial there at 601 James R. Thompson Boulevard. That's on the campus of the college there in East St. Louis. That's 601 James R. Thompson Boulevard in East St. Louis. That's July 2nd at 6 p.m. You'll see many of the descendants there will be speaking, and then they have a series of activities, including a tour of some of the commemorative plaques where significant things happened during that race war.
I remember the last time I was over there when there was an event, I was like questioning why weren't there some plaques and something that says, this is what happened here, and it says, it's coming. So it sounds like it's now there.
It is.
Yeah,
this event is being co-sponsored by, the main sponsor is the East St. Louis Historical Society, and then also the Metro East Organizing Coalition and Heritage Programs. And Walker, if any of you all know her, she has her organization. She's very much involved in this, as well as our family. So you have some of the descendants that's involved in helping to put this together, and those two major organizations.
Yeah. Because I think it's going to be those entities, both descendants and historians, that keep the story alive and
Absolutely.
keep it to the truth. Because otherwise, you know, it's going to be rewritten in a way that doesn't reflect the real history of our people and the truth about what really happened over there in East St. Louis. Terry Kennedy, Kujaliwa,
Yes, ma'am.
Hukuma, thank you for joining us today and sharing your family's history. And that, it ought to motivate us to really kind of do the genealogy of our own family, because I often say, like, we don't know what our good things our family did, because we didn't, we're not going back and talking to great grandma and like what happened. In some cases that needs to happen, because there's a certain amount of shame about, you know, our history, whether it be because we're enslaved people. That, you know, the trauma of talking about it is real, but we need to find a way to get those stories out and pass them on down and put them in written form. That's very, very important.
For many of the descendants of the race war did not want to talk about it.
Exactly. Can you blame them?
No, not after all that trauma.
No.
And but, you know, if you brought it to them, well, our folks made sure we knew, but some information we had to drag out of them. Because they just didn't want to talk about it. It was that kind of trauma.
Right.
That kind of trauma.
Right. But yeah, so we want to see people on July 2nd over there in East St. Louis. That's going to be posted to my website, JamalaRogers.com, so that you can be reminded of this and get the real history about what's happening. We're going to close out with a excerpt. Like I said, an excerpt of Frederick Douglass's What to the 4th of July is to the Slave, and is narrated by none other than the great late Ossie Davis.
Ossie Davis.
And so we thank you for listening. This is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield. I hope I get this right. Okay.
But more than all other days in the year, what to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. Mm. To him, your celebration is a sham. Mm. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may. Search where you will. Roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America. Search out every abuse. And when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
Okay, that is enough for us to marinate on and to really reflect on as we go into the holiday, because that is still real. Thank again, Sante, for being with us, and I will see you next week at the commemoration to Tanzania.